You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 80 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And this is the Pro Bowl edition of the Peltoncast.
For Steve Largent?
For Pro Bowler Steve Largent. We have so much sports to get to. This might be the most sports that we have to get to of any Peltoncast ever.
That's possible. 538, I think, maybe popularized the concept of the sports equinox, which was when like all four major pro sports are in action on the same day, which happens occasionally in late October or in early November. We don't quite have that because we don't have a basketball team, but there's a lot of sports teams in action right now, and we've got to talk about all of them and some other stuff.
There's a lot of stuff, but before then, let's talk about not sports for 1 second. Let's talk about what we're drinking here today.
So we are drinking something I picked up during our trip to the Tri-Cities over the summer. They had at the Costco there a handful of Spokane beers, which you usually do not see on this side.
This is a beer that's aged a little bit.
It is. It's been a while since I got this in August, when I think the idea of a golden ale brewed with vanilla bean and orange peel probably sounded a tad more appealing than it does on November 7th. But this is the Orangelicious Golden Ale from Orlison Brewing Company.
Orlison?
Orlison.
All right.
In Spokane, Washington. So, or I guess technically Airway Heights, Washington.
Oh, yeah.
So that's,
if you're going to be technical. By the way, this is unrelated. Have you seen how large the list of Seahawks injuries are in Pro Football Reference?
That's a lot. It's a lot of injuries.
There's not even a Pro Bowl designation, and they have, or a probable designation, and they have a probable player.
That is remarkable how they pulled that off.
They managed to invent a designation just for that. Let me crack this open, but we have some things to toast to here also.
We do. We have a couple of things here. So first off, we're going to toast to our loyal listener, Nate, who, whoa, it looks like that got shook up on the trip back from the Tri-Cities.
It's still volcanoing over the top right now.
All right, as I was saying, first off, a toast to our loyal listener, Nate, who is the winner of last week's Peltoncast hat competition. A literally ones of replies from the listener as people were trying to guess how many yards Seahawks running backs would have in last Sunday's game against Washington.
Nate has won everything in the Peltoncast orbit.
That's true. The trivia.
He's the rightful winner of this hat because he should have gotten one for trivia. We didn't have them in time.
Yeah, we teased the possibility of maybe getting them, but didn't manage to do it.
But he wins at Peltoncast trivia, wins the Peltoncast hat giveaway. Also, was a huge winner because he came to the Peltoncast live show.
That's true. So the Seahawks running backs actually had 71 yards. Nate guessed 62. He just beat out loyal listener Ben B, who guessed 60. And therefore won the hat. So again, can think of few people more deserving for the hat. So if you're finished wiping up the spill here, let's toast.
It's everywhere. Cheers to Nate.
Yeah.
Mm. Also wanted cheers.
That's an interesting taste.
Yeah, not my favorite.
It's
very orange sickle.
It is very orange.
I'm curious how it's going to pair with my side beer, the Rubens Goza.
Yeah, not a great pairing.
Also wanted a toast to something good that happened on Sunday. Something bad happened also, but to redeem the day, you were down in Portland for this, and the Blazers taking out the Thunder, who are now under 500?
They are now 4-6 after losing Tuesday night in Sacramento.
Well under 500.
Yeah, they also have the third best point differential in the league, so I don't think this is going to be lasting. Let's put it that way. But it was an eventful game marked by Carmelo Anthony getting ejected for a flagrant foul committed, flagrant two foul committed on offense as he was shooting.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
How did he do that?
He was going up, and as he was going in the motion, Jusuf Nurkić came over to contest the shot, and Anthony elbowed him in the face. So on the court, they called it a foul on Nurkić and a free throws for Anthony. Instead, then they reversed it, not just to an offensive foul, not just to a flagrant foul, but a flagrant two, which resulted in his ejection from the game.
This was like that Todd Gurley fumble in the end zone for the Seahawks. It's like, it's not only is this not a touchdown, it's also the other team's ball.
Right. So this was a source of some controversy after the game. And What happens when there's a controversial call like this is one member of the media is selected as a pool reporter to go talk to the referee and get their statement about it.
Uh-huh. You have a smug smile on your face.
And I was that pool reporter.
Is this your first ever time as the pool reporter?
That is my first time, yeah.
Wow, how did you get selected?
Well, basically because I wasn't ready on deadline like most of the people who were there, and specifically the Thunder reporters who had actually submitted a question, because you have to submit the questions ahead of time, and you aren't allowed to follow up or anything like that. And it's funny, there really is no purpose to me actually being there, because I literally just had to read verbatim the pre-submitted question.
That they'd already seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then a member of the Blazers PR staff was there to record it and send the audio back to the league.
So you did nothing.
I literally read the question off his phone. That's all I did.
Did you give him a wink for like a good foul? Good call?
No, I did not do that.
The Thunder reporter should have known who they were selecting.
Don't be ridiculous here. I said on Twitter that I did not agree with that call.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it should have been a flagrant one, if a flagrant foul at all.
So you were down in Portland. Did you get to eat anything while you were down there?
I did. So I went down early to watch the Seahawks game in Portland, which I don't know if it was better or worse to watch it there at a Buffalo Wild Wings as opposed to listening to it on the drive, which probably would have resulted in me like pounding my my steering wheel.
You might have driven off the road
on numerous occasions. But I, before the game started, I went over to Stanich's to try the number one burger in the country.
Wow!
According to Thrillist Kevin A. Alexander, who you'll recall joined us on the podcast back in
number
May
one when burger he released his in ranking. The country. I mean, I am so excited. We have not talked about this. So excited to hear about this burger.
So
did you have the exact burger?
I didn't, because he, you'll recall, had the basic cheeseburger. I think he had what's called the Nick's cheeseburger there. Mm-hmm. Their famous burger, they call it the world famous burger, also comes with egg and I think ham. And various accoutrements.
And that's what you got?
That's what I got.
Okay. Why didn't you get the exact burger?
Well, that's the more famous one. Like, Kevin was the one who was not. It was like going to Dick's and ordering the cheeseburger. And said, I mean, not that extreme, but that's equivalent to what
so
he was doing.
So you ended up getting a burger with ham and an egg on it? I guess, was it breakfast time?
It was like 12:30 at that point. It was brunch time in Portland.
Okay.
For sure.
I'll deem that appropriate. How was the burger?
So we talked about this before. You said if it literally wasn't the best burger I'd ever had, it was going to fail to live up to expectations.
Yes.
And it was not, sadly. I would say that I think actually if I had to do it over again, I would do the Nick's cheeseburger, because even though they were like, it was interesting to have the egg on there, like ultimately I think it detracted from the strongest part of the burger was the cheese. It was really well melted.
Hmm.
The patties are giant. This is an enormous burger.
So this wasn't a situation where you could have ordered both burgers?
No, that was definitely not a possibility.
You might have died.
And like cooked very slowly on the grill right behind the counter so I could see the whole process. They talked a lot. The descriptions of Stanich's described it as kind of an old school sports bar. It was not as much a sports bar as I expected. It turned out not to be a place I could watch the Seahawks.
They didn't have the Seahawks on.
They had it on, but they had just like two kind of small TVs and none of the packages or anything. So, and didn't have the sound on. So it wasn't like a sports driven bar, I wouldn't say. And it was probably divier than I expected based on
how many people were in there.
Yeah, there was like four or five groups, I would say.
Huh.
So the patty itself was, you know, kind of average, I would say. It wasn't outstanding. Like I said, I think the cheese was the real standout. And maybe on the cheeseburger that would have stood out more. But I wouldn't say as it was that the burger that I had would have made the final eight in Seattle.
Not the final eight?
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Holy cow.
I mean, again, everyone has different tastes. My preferences for burgers tend to run toward more of the fast food style smaller burgers, but
still the final eight.
Yeah.
Man. I mean, I was thinking we were talking about this in terms of the top burgers.
Yeah. I definitely wouldn't say it comes close to comparing to the Unita Loretta's class.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So we're going to Portland in December right after Christmas. How far out of my way should I go to eat at Stanich's?
I mean, I think it's definitely worth trying. And you might like the burger more than I did. We don't always agree about burgers, as we found out in the search for Seattle's best burger. But I wouldn't prioritize it over going to Pock Pock or Screen Door.
Interesting. Huh. Did you have any other food recommendations?
Well, I've tried a couple of different places. You and I both went to one of them before the Husky game 2 weeks ago. That being the Maono fried chicken sandwiches stand, basically, in Rachel's Ginger Beer in the U Village. And this, I think, is one of Seattle's hidden gems, I would say.
Hidden gems?
I mean, there was almost no one in there when we went there. Granted, it was like 10 a.m. on a Saturday because yes. It was the 12:30 start against UCLA, but those chicken sandwiches were outstanding.
How do you compare them to the Sunset Fried Chicken on the Rachel's on 15th?
So these are much bigger, again, than the ones at Sunset.
12? On 12th?
It's on 12th, yes. These are much bigger, I would say. I mean, they're different. Like, those are more traditional chicken sandwiches, although you can order a few different kinds. I like to get the General Tso, which is like kind of has an Asian-style sauce on it, that sort of thing. This is more in the spirit of Maono, which is kind of Hawaiian-style cooking. And also, they complement it. You can order a cheese sauce to go yes. with the chicken sandwich, which doesn't sound good, but it really did quite work and was great with the fries.
Yeah. So, I thought it was great. I mean, giant pieces of chicken.
I would say I prefer the Maono fried chicken sandwich to the Sunset. They're both good.
I would have liked to have tried the chicken strips, just plain chicken strips, not even in a sandwich. And I'm a big fan of chicken sandwiches. I thought it was excellent. And I mean, like, anything paired with a Rachel's Ginger Beer drink is going to taste pretty good. It's a great combo, especially in a sunny Saturday morning in the fall. But I thought it was excellent.
All right, the last spot I hit up is a place you've been before, right?
Yes.
Dozone, which recently opened in the International District in addition to, I think, 4 locations on the east side.
Wow, 4 locations?
I think so. So I went there for lunch last week. A bit of a line, but they moved people through pretty quickly, waited about 10, maybe 15 minutes right at 12:30, right at kind of the peak of lunchtime.
That's not bad.
And so the comparison, obviously, is to Din Tai Fung,
yes.
which is the bigger, especially within Seattle city limits, of the dumpling places in the Seattle area. And I would say that what really stood out is the soup dumplings to me at Dozone were far better.
Far better.
Far better than the Din Tai Fung.
I've only been to Dozone one time and they were out of soup dumplings when I went there. I should have stormed out.
You should have. I see. So we tried like a variety of different types of dumplings.
Naturally.
And I would say in hindsight, I might just go all soup dumplings.
All soup?
Yeah, they were that good.
It's the best dumpling.
It is.
Yeah. I'm so sad about this now.
We have talked about having a dumpling taste test, including those two locations.
I'm ready. I'm ready to have a dumpling taste test.
Dumplings of Fury, to which you have not been yet. So they do not do soup dumplings.
They don't do soup dumplings?
Competition. No.
The soup dumpling is the king of the dumpling.
It is.
It's the best dumpling. It's like having soup and a dumpling all in one.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's why those are both in the name. So stay tuned for that, possibly on a winter Pelton Cast episode. We don't have so much sports to talk.
Oh, man. Well, I just wanted to say one time. Have I said this on a Pelton Cast before? I had last Wednesday, for the first time in months, I went to the Tats truck, which is parked a couple blocks from my work. And the turkey tatsdrami from the Tats food truck, it's like a Philly-style sandwich, a pastrami sandwich normally, and they do it with turkey. Easily the best sandwich in Seattle.
All right, I'm going to have to try that. So I've been to Tats, but I did not order that. I think I had the chicken cordon bleu.
Come on. I'm saying this turkey tatsdrami, you know, a lot of times when you get a sandwich like this, it kind of is just a lot of meat.
Right.
Right? And you're like, okay, this is fine, but meat kind of tends to just taste like meat. This is the most flavorful meat I have ever had on a sandwich.
Wow.
And naturally, it's, you know, there's tons of it on there, but you could eat the meat on its own and it would taste excellent. And then it's pulled together with the roll and the Russian dressing. I mean, it is perfect discovering the sandwich. The pastrami is not as good. You have to go with the turkey tatsdrami sandwich. It is easily the best sandwich in Seattle.
All right. Oh, I did the chicken parm. That's what I did. Yeah, so next time I'll deal with that.
I mean, I hadn't had it in months. And when I had it, the first bite, I'm like, why am I not eating this every single week when this food truck is parked here? Yeah. What am I doing? Should we get to sports? Because we have so much sports to get to.
So first we're going to get to politics, which is, of course, sports, this being Seattle at this point. So tonight, as we're recording this, is the day of the election in Seattle and obviously throughout the country. But notably, the mayoral election for the city of Seattle. And my expectation was that we wouldn't find out anything tonight, that we'd get an early return, but it would be close enough that we still couldn't tell between Jenny Durkin and Carrie Moon. And that expectation was way wrong. Because Jenny Durkin is, in fact, up an insurmountable 20 points. And, you know, even though I don't think there's been a concession as we record this, has been declared by media outlets the next mayor of Seattle and the first female mayor in, what is it, 90 years?
Wow. 90
years? A long time.
I mean, guaranteed either way, but yes.
It was, yes. So, as we've discussed on the podcast previously, you know, Durkin has been, what was her term, stridently neutral? Something along those lines between the two Seattle Arena proposals, whereas Carrie Moon showed more preference for the Key Arena renovation and specifically talked about how she was not in favor of taking away industrial land to use on an entertainment district around an arena in SoTo, which basically would have meant that the SoTo Arena proposal was not viable. It would have been dead at that point because that's a key part of it. If you're going to consider it, even if you're going to consider it as a second arena alongside a key, renovated Key Arena. So I think this is certainly good news on the, if you're a fan of the SoTo Arena plan. Some of the other races that are being decided also will affect that. On the Seattle City Council, would say no surprise that Lorena Gonzalez looks to be overwhelmingly reelected to her position. The other open spot on the council, which this person will take office right away because of the fact that this seat was vacated by Tim Burgess when he became mayor, Teresa Mosqueda is leading John Grant by 23 points. And Grant had been very anti-SoTo Arena in the past.
So. Really?
Another bit of good news there for SoTo Arena fans. The news maybe not quite as good on the Port of Seattle Council or among the commissioners. So two of the contenders who had generally been considered anti-SoTo Arena, and obviously the Port of Seattle has been a staunch critic, a longtime critic of the SoTo plan. Two of them, Stephanie Bowman and then Peter Steinbrück, who was particularly vocal in his opposition to the SoTo Arena possibility. They're both cruising to victories. But the number one port commissioner spot, John Creighton, who has been the spokesperson for the port, has led their efforts against the SoTo Arena. He's locked in a tight battle right now with challenger Ryan Calkins, the leading 51.5% to 48.5% in the first returns on Tuesday night. So that's one that we're going to want to continue to follow in the days and weeks to come.
Okay. Any other progress on arena news aside from politics?
Oh, there's a lot besides that.
Because there's a lot of everything this week.
There is a lot of everything. So Tim Leiwicki of Oakview Group has been making a bit of a media tour lately. He's been making the rounds. There was a feature in the Seattle Times last week. This week, an hour-long sit-down with Bill Wixie of Q13 that they've been splitting up into several chunks. And I would say that, and first off, by the way, if Tim Leiwicki would like to extend his media tour to the Pelton cast, we're happy to have us. We're happy to have him. Peltoncast@gmail.com. Hit us up. So the main things he's been trying to play up is that the NBA is a real possibility because of the fact that there's been such a question among Sonics fans of, you know, if we renovate Key Arena, is it just going to be hockey and concerts? Are they actually going to attract an NBA team? So he's been trying to emphasize that financially it's better for them to have an NBA team. And discussing the possibility of David Bonderman, who will be part of the hockey ownership group, could also lead up an NBA ownership group. So here's a couple of quotes from that interview with Bill Wixie. "We have the money and the wherewithal to get both teams if that's what Mr. Bonderman decides to do. But we believe we have other friends in the family that very much want to join us in that endeavor." And one thing that was mentioned in the Seattle Times piece by Jeff Baker is that they've talked with the Ackerley children, the sons of former Sonics owner Barry Ackerley, about potentially being part of this group as kind of a local representative. That'd be interesting because, of course, one of the notable things that happened under Barry Ackerley when Key Arena was renovated in 1995 was that they designed it not to NHL specifications so that the Sonics would not at that point have to face any competition from another winter team, a decision that does not look particularly good with the benefit of
hindsight. How do we feel about the Ackerleys in with regards to this?
I mean,
sold the team to the guy who sold the team that moved the team.
That's, you can't really blame them for that. That's too many levels removed.
Okay.
But I would say that the legacy of the Ackerleys as owners would be mixed.
Okay.
I would put it that way. Certainly experienced a lot of success under Barry Ackerley, including those many trips to the NBA Finals, or many trips to the many 55-plus win seasons, the one trip to the NBA Finals in 96.
We're just rewriting history on the podcast.
The other quote from him from Tim Iwicki, to go back to this Bill Wixie interview, we have friends of mine and friends of David Bonderman that would love to be part of the NBA. By the way, David Bonderman owns a piece of an NBA team, that being the Celtics. We have an ownership group already, and that ownership group is very capable of going out and getting a team. So this is by far the strongest talk we've seen from Tim Iwicki about the NBA possibility, something he's kind of downplayed in the past. I don't know if that reflects his desire to kind of win over the critics or whether it's a response to what he's hearing about the league. We've talked in the past about, you know, the finances of big market teams versus small market teams, making it perhaps more likely that a team ultimately relocates. Although in that case, it's not necessarily clear that it would be sold to be relocated. It's possible that it could be an existing owner coming in with a team.
Interesting. So, I mean, the idea of Bonderman being the owner is a little bit more appealing, right?
Yes.
Because the biggest issue that we see with this group and an NBA owner is that they're not going to own a piece of the property. Therefore, the profits that they can attain are going to be much lower than an owner, say, Chris Hansen, right?
So Iwicki has also said that they would cut and be willing to cut an NBA owner into the deal as a one-third owner, with the NHL ownership group also being a one-third owner of the arena.
That's the thing you say before the deal is done. But I'm sure they'd be willing to give up a third of the deal. But Bonderman is already part of the group.
It's much easier that way. Yes. If Bonderman is, in fact, interested in owning the NBA, or at least in Seattle. Additional Seattle arena news. Members of local music community, I think 33 of them in all, sent a letter to the mayor, to Mayor Tim Burgess and the city council, supporting the Soto Street vacation and the music-only renovation of Key Arena proposed by the Soto Arena Group. Notable names among this group: Macklemore, Ben London, who previously wrote an editorial in support of music-only renovation, Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Ben London with the billing over Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Just because of his previous role in this. Sir Mix-a-Lot has not written any editorials as yet. Duff McKagan, who we mentioned his support on Twitter a few weeks ago.
Now, Sir Mix-a-Lot has said, Seattle, jump on it. That's not okay.
I don't think that was related specifically to this. Members of the Presidents of the United States of America, local music promoter Dave Meinert, or a music venue owner, I guess,
and manager,
reps of AG Live Northwest, which also runs Bumbershoot in Seattle, and notably on the Seattle Center campus.
Wow, and a notable omission.
You got left off this?
Yeah, peltoncast@gmail.com. Come on.
is a player in the music industry in Seattle. What did you think of this this letter?
I don't know. I didn't think much of the letter.
Do you think it reflects a sentiment within the music community?
It might reflect a sentiment within the music community. I'm just not sure what it means.
Like what impact it has?
Yes.
Yes. But it's better than not having that support.
Sure.
So lastly on the arena.
I'm going to say the multi-billion dollar group trying to renovate the arena and submitting the proposal and going through this process means a lot more than this letter.
So you're talking about AEG then?
No. Yeah. Then. Wow. But I'm saying that it's very nice that they did this. I'm just not sure that it's going to sway anything.
So lastly, a bit of a discussion broke out about the arena timeline during the Seattle City Council meeting on Monday, where, as reported by Chris Daniels of King 5, council member Mike O'Brien expressed his concern about the timetable of the vote. Here was his quote. I just want to flag that I'm struggling during budget season, because that's what's going on for the council right now, to keep up with the complexity of it. And I've tried to dig into it, that being the deal with OFIO, the memorandum of understanding that they would vote on. But I got to say, the budget is taking all of my attention. I'm feeling very squeezed on the timeline that we're supposed to vote this out of, which, of course, the hopeful date would be December 4th, as soon as the memorandum of understanding with the Chris Hansen Soto group expires, is when they hope to vote on this. Council President Bruce Harrell, in reply, said, I'm hopeful we get it done this year. And then there was also notably here a bit of a Kinsley gaffe by Mike O'Brien when he mentioned, I know that the timetable is because we're trying to get an NHL team by 2020. So this is something that everyone knows is what's going on, but no member of the ownership group or the Seattle City government has actually said out loud. So it's a classic Kinsley gaffe. A gaffe is when a politician tells the truth, some obvious truth he isn't supposed to say.
But why? What does the timeline matter for NHL in 2020?
Well, if they're going to start construction in time to have the arena open in the fall of 2020, which is the timetable they've laid out in the memorandum of understanding, then it would have to be approved by the end of the year, I think.
Interesting.
So we've talked in the past about, you know, whether it's appropriate to fast track this vote and, you know, the due diligence that's necessary on a deal of this size for an arena that's going to be around for decades for opening it 1 year early. When you put it in those terms, it seems hard to justify.
Yeah, I mean, if we were looking at this in terms of basketball, though, a year is a big deal.
A year is a big deal, but 40 years are a bigger deal. Like, don't you wish the original Key Arena deal had been done a little differently?
Ugh.
All right. On that note, there is basketball in Seattle, and we are not here referring to the Seattle Storm because it is not summertime, but instead to University of Washington basketball, which the men kicked off last week with an exhibition against St. Martin's and a thrilling 91-87 come from behind 91-87 win over St. Martin's.
They gave up 87 points to St. Martin's.
So I'm excited. It's the first time in a while that we're going to get to tick off this bingo square. Opponent 3-point shooting is random. And in this game, St. Martin's went 18 of 34 from three-point range, which eventually caused the Huskies in the second half to switch out of Mike Hopkins' trademark 2-3 zone into more of a pressing man-to-man, which helped facilitate their comeback.
Let me just say about Mike Hopkins' zone. They abandoned it within the first half of the first game against St. Martin's. This is the zone that we're bringing over from Syracuse.
So
couldn't crack St. Martin's.
Again, opponent three-point shooting is random. What concerns me here is the fact that St. Martin's got up 34 attempts. No opponent attempted even 33s in a game against the Huskies last season. 29 was the season high for UW opponents. Syracuse historically has allowed one of the highest three-attempt rates in the country under Jim Boeheim playing that same 2-3 zone that Hopkins is bringing with him. But intriguingly, the Syracuse zone does appear to be the exception to the rule that defenses can't really control the three-point percentage that opponents can shoot against them.
So they give up a lot of Syracuse gives up a lot of threes, but they don't give up a high three-point percentage.
I mean,
or they limit the amount of
Sometimes
games.
Sometimes they give up a high three-point percentage, but on average, their three-point percentage does seem to be somewhat lower than the national average, which is very unusual in college basketball. Ken Pomeroy actually specifically wrote a piece about this that I've linked on Sonic Central on the Pelton Cast page called The Boeheim Exception. So that'll be interesting to watch.
Jim Boeheim's probably never played St. Martin's.
Well, you'll recall, I remember, like, I think it was during the Wes Johnson year where Syracuse was actually very good and they lost their exhibition opener as a ranked team.
Did they really? Okay.
Yeah, so it happens sometimes.
Okay.
You can't read too much into one game in college basketball. On the Huskies side, Noah Dickerson really dominated a tiny St. Martin's front line. He went for 21-10 with 17 free throw attempts, which that's really something. David Chris had 18 points and 14 apiece for Matisse Thybul and Jalen Noel, the lone remaining freshman recruited by Lorenzo Romar before he was fired. Noel had a crucial score late in the game that helped put St. Martin's away. So before the season kicks off for the Huskies this Friday against Belmont, I guess we should talk a little bit about sort of, you know, what we're expecting from this season. And it's probably going to be a long season. Ken Pom projects the Huskies number 130 in the country, 11th in the Pac-12, ahead of only Washington State, which is projected number 241.
My God.
Not great times on the place for Cougar basketball. Cougar
200? Men's are there that many teams that Ken Pom is projecting?
There's like 350, I think. Indeed.
Wow.
Ken Pom projecting 6-12 conference record for the Huskies on average and 14-16 overall, which, you know what, I would definitely take that right now. I think some things to watch, Matisse Thybul's development, you know, he's kind of the guy that I think we're looking at to step into the go-to scoring role without Markel Fultz, without, you know, players who really excel at creating their own shots. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the confidence that he's built over the summer, had a big game in the Jamal Crawford Pro-Am in terms of scoring, which was nice to see, even if the competition is low. David Crisp certainly will be a big factor as well. And then Dickerson inside. It was interesting that Dickerson basically exclusively played center in this game.
Okay, I like that.
And I mean
who would the other options be at center?
Well, Sam Timmons is the other main option. And then you've also got Devenir DeRusso is still in the mix. I don't think he played at all against St. Martin, so it seems unlikely that he will be seeing extended action. But Timmons, who, you know, started at times last season, did not play much in this game. And I don't know how much of that it was kind of a matchup issue going up against St. Martin's and a team that wanted to, you know, get up, obviously, a lot of three-pointers.
Aside from Jalen Noel, the incoming freshman, who are some other players who are new to the team that we should be looking to contribute?
So the other two freshmen who got action last in the exhibition opener were the two guys from New York, Naz Carter.
Okay.
Who you'll recall, nephew of Jay-Z.
Mm-hmm.
He played 16 minutes and scored 10 points in his debut. You know, looks to get a lot of action on the wing. And then Hamir Wright will probably play a lot at, is kind of, if Dickerson is going to be playing the five, then Wright basically becomes the only real power forward on the roster, where, you know, I think Thibel is basically going to start at that position. But you know, if you want a more traditional power forward to match up with teams and they don't want to play both Dickerson and Sam Timmons together, then Wright is probably that guy. So he played 11 minutes in the opener, did not score.
What was the starting lineup for that game against St. Martin's?
Went with Crisp and Noel in the backcourt, Dominic Green and Thibel at forwards.
Oh, Dominic Green.
Yeah. Dominic Green played 23 minutes, scored 8 points.
Okay. Dominic Green was there too.
And so we basically talked about the entire rotation with the exception of Carlos Johnson as a sophomore who played 22 minutes. He had 6 points, seven boards in the opener.
So honestly, the team doesn't look all that different than the Markelle Fultz list team that we saw quite a bit last year.
Yes. Not as much Dean Kingba in the mix. He also did not play in the exhibition.
Is there a chance that just by sake of another year of experience that they're better than they were last year?
Yeah, I think that's... I think that's to be expected, better than they were, again, without Fultz.
But the team without Fultz was really bad.
I do not believe they won a game without Fultz. Although they they did have some pretty good efforts late in the season, including in the Pac-12 tournament, when they were very competitive, but did not win a game, I don't think.
And then what should we expect from Jalen Noel going into the season?
They did lose their final 13 games of last season. I'd kind of forgotten that.
You know,
things were bad.
Who's counting?
Oh, boy.
What should we expect from Jalen Noel? Is he a one-and-done type player? Is he a four-year type player? What is he? What are his strengths and his weaknesses?
I mean, I haven't seen a ton of Noel, so this is, you know, mostly secondhand. I can't remember. It was either him or Dejon Davis didn't play. I think it was Dejon Davis who didn't play the one game I saw Garfield down in Portland against...
Who's still in high school.
No, Dejon Davis is at Stanford.
Oh.
He opted against his commitment to UW after the coaching change. So he's more of an off-ball guard. He was really playing on the ball in that game because of the fact that Davis was injured. Has some ability to handle it, but, you know, is more of the classic two-guard. He's probably not big enough. He probably doesn't have this combination of size and skill that you would necessarily need to be an NBA prospect, but it's a possibility that he could get there over the course of his career.
Can he shoot?
I think he can shoot okay.
Okay.
Again, I've seen him play like that one game in person, and then I watched their other game against Nathan Hale when it was on ESPNU.
But so we shouldn't be expecting a ton from him as a freshman.
I mean, he's going to play. He's going to get an opportunity. I mean, he's not going to come in and be what Markelle was or DeJounte Murray even the year before, but he'll be a contributor.
Okay.
I mean, I think, is it reasonable to expect him to be maybe what Terrence Ross was as a freshman before he really blossomed as a sophomore? I think that's maybe a realistic expectation.
All right, I'll take it.
Of course, Terrence Ross at that point was like the fourth wing behind CJ Wilcox, and I might have been Justin Holiday was still on the team at that point. Like, it's a very
He wasn't
different...
starting from day one.
He was not.
Yeah.
It's very different. So looking at this week, Belmont coming to town on Friday, and this is a terrible matchup for the Huskies in almost every regard. So Belmont has been a relative fixture in the NCAA tournament. They made it 7 of the last 12 years under their head coach, Rick Byrd, who is entering his 32nd season.
Wow.
That's some strong continuity.
Nice.
For Belmont. They went 15-1 last year in Ohio Valley Conference play, but then lost to Jacksonville State in the conference tournament, were forced to go to the NIT where they lost in the second round. They led the NCAA by making 61% of their two-point attempts, and they were number two in the country in the percentage of their shots that came from three-point range, which seems like it could be a problem for this Huskies side. And then their senior point guard, Austin Luke, ranked eighth in the country last year in assist rate, so he's an exceptional playmaker and will probably be setting up open shooters on a regular basis.
Great. So if the Huskies beat Belmont, though, it's a big deal.
That would be, yeah, it would be, I mean, like on paper, it's not actually that surprising. I think that Belmont comes in almost equivalent in terms of the Ken Pomeroy ranks. So when you account for home court advantage, the Huskies are a favored to win 62% of the time.
Really?
Yeah, but we know. Like, we know.
I'm kind of surprised that Belmont isn't rated higher, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think they probably were higher than that last year. I mean, they finished the season 83rd last year.
Huh. Okay.
Let's see. In terms of
Belmont is not as, should not be as feared as you're saying. I mean, the Huskies are going to lose this game. Don't get me wrong.
They also don't have like that, you know, that Kay Felder or Jameel Warney, the guy who's an NBA prospect who's going to just destroy the Huskies. They don't have that kind of talent.
Look, this is a Lorenzo Romero-less Huskies. We don't know what to expect.
We don't know. That's true. Last year, they did not beat a Power 5 team that I can tell. They did in the NIT, actually. They beat Georgia in the NIT, but their non-conference schedule, they lost by 14 at Vanderbilt, by 17 at Florida, by 9 at Rhode Island. And then, yeah, that was it for them against Power 5 teams.
Okay, so this is a winnable game.
I mean, I'm just not getting my hopes up. I've been here, but I've been hurt before. On Sunday, the Huskies will take on Eastern Washington, which surprisingly is the first time they've played Eastern since 2014 when they won 81-77. This is the first game for Eastern under their new head coach, Shante Lagans, who you may remember from playing at Cal many years ago back when I was going to UW. Yeah, some people, not necessarily you, but the listener might remember him. Their former coach, Jim Hayford, got the Seattle U job over the summer.
Oh, really?
And that opened up. Lagans was an assistant there. They went 13-5 in Big Sky play last season. And then UW women's basketball also opens up on Sunday. They'll be hosting Idaho State.
Should the Huskies beat Eastern?
They should, yeah. If they don't beat Eastern, then it's going to be a real long season. A real long season.
Okay, well, I'm very curious to see this. I mean, we're not going to see any of the Belmont game because it's directly opposite.
Yeah, I mean, that's so frustrating. Stanford. I would love to go see Belmont. Belmont is precisely the kind of team I would love to go see. But
so stupid. God, drives me crazy. Okay.
I mean, I assume that was not intentional. Let's talk about the Sounders.
Talk about the rain first? Can we talk about the Seattle Rain first before we talk about the Sounders?
All right, if we're going to go in that order in the soccer. The Seattle Rain making news today is they're the only head coach and GM they'd ever had in franchise history. Laura Harvey stepped down. A report from 442 that Harvey, who is the head coach of the USA under 23 women's national team, will likely take an expanded role with US soccer and could potentially be the ultimate successor to the current USWNT head coach, Jill Ellis.
Nice.
So she had been considered a possible candidate for the England managerial job that was open right now. She's an English native, but apparently the USWNT wanted to keep her in the fold, and that seems to have explained this. She was a two-time NWSL Coach of the Year. Both of those years, the Rain won the NWSL Shield with the best record in the regular season in the league, and both of those years they reached the championship game only to lose there. The Rain has wasted no time hiring a successor. They hired away from FC Kansas City coach Vlatko Andonovsky, who led Kansas City to beating the Rain in the championship game both those two times that they made it in 2014 and 2015. Intriguingly, both of those teams since playing in the 2015 championship game have missed the playoffs the last 2 years in the NWSL format, where only 4 teams out of 10 make it. And it was an interesting note, I thought, on the 442 post that said that no two WNSL coaches have more similar approaches than Harvey and Andonovsky. So it should be some continuity there for a Rain team that is trying to get back to the playoffs.
All right. So and the Sounders.
So a toast is definitely in order here, even though you ran out of beer.
I've still got my side beer.
Okay, yeah. Toast that with that. To the Sounders, who have advanced to the Western Conference Finals for the second year in a row, beating the rival Vancouver Whitecaps 2-0 in the home leg of their two-game aggregate series, which also finished 2-0. So you were at this game. Tell me what it was like.
Well, first, shouts to Third Punt Brother James for coming and watching the game with me and the famous cousin Katie and Baby Fantasy Genius.
Yeah.
Who we might have to rename because of not because of his fantasy ability, because of mine. but this was kind of an uneventful game. It didn't feel like the type of game that was going to send the Sounders to the Western Conference Championship.
Like, it didn't feel like that in terms of the
hype, the magnitude of it.
It just felt like an ordinary game.
It kind of felt like an ordinary game.
I mean, that sometimes happens in the playoffs. I mean, last year the matches...
It wasn't empty, though. It was full.
Yeah, which is good, because I was very worried given the short turnaround. The nice thing is, now the Sounders will have a long time to sell their home leg of their Western Conference Finals series against the Houston Dynamo, because they won't be playing that until November 30th, 23 days from today.
November 30th?
Yep.
You know what I like to say is, right when you've got them hooked, right when you're in the throes of the playoffs, I like to have a 3-week break.
Well, they'll be on the road November 21st in the first leg of that series. They got home field advantage.
That's still how many days from now? 14 days from now?
That is 2 weeks from now, and it will be 19 days from the last time they played. But they got home field advantage as a result of Houston upsetting Portland in the other quarterfinal, or the other semifinal leg, in Portland, a game that was taking place while I was down in Portland on Sunday night.
I'm going to toast to that also. Yeah. As sad as I am to not see the Sounders run the table through the Cascadia Cup.
Houston drew Portland 1-1, but because those teams had drawn in the leg in Houston, Houston won on the away goals tiebreaker. Or maybe they won 2-1. I might be wrong about that. But they would have won either way. They didn't need the second goal. Whether I am wrong about the actual score or not there. And the winning goal supplied by former Sounder Dylan Remick.
Really?
Yeah. So it was 2-1. So any other takeaways from being in attendance there?
Not a ton.
What was the reaction to Quint Dempsey scoring a couple times? Because he has not had a great playoff legacy in Seattle. And then obviously was suspended for the first leg of the series, but came back to score twice in this game.
People love Quint. I just don't think it was it was a different kind of reaction than we would have had from anybody else scoring, though.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, he obviously...
It was just excitement about scoring a goal. It's funny because in the situation, the way that it works with road goals is you go from this... It's almost more nerve-wracking somehow to score.
Because now if the other team scores...
Then it's over.
Yeah, you lose.
You go from the state of it's 0-0. The Sounders are kind of dominating possession, although no team really dominated too much. Maybe the Sounders have slightly better chances, and you're like, oh, they might get a goal. But then once they get the goal, all of a sudden you're playing a little bit defensive. The Sounders really didn't end up with the second goal that ended it. But you're playing defensive, and let's say that something crazy happens. Vancouver gets, you know, like a run, or they start dominating possession because they're playing more aggressive soccer, and boom, the game is over. I mean, it's a very strange way to watch soccer.
But they didn't have many chances in this match, it didn't seem.
No, and there was no real threat there. It was in our hearts.
Yeah. No, I completely understand what you're saying, but the Sounders really kind of dominated possession and were able to get the second goal. 538, the Soccer Power Index gives the Sounders a 61% chance of advancing to their second consecutive MLS Cup.
Wow.
So we'll have a full preview of Houston next week leading into that first leg.
Sometime in the next 6 weeks before that match happens.
The MLS season is so long. It's crazy.
I can't believe that they have a break in between the playoff rounds.
It always happens. It happened last year.
It's so bad.
All right, should we talk about Husky football?
All right.
Can we have a toast?
Ugh!
To beating Oregon at home for the first time in 14 years. The weird thing is, like you were saying about this match for the Sounders, this game kind of weirdly anticlimactic because of the fact that the Huskies scored 38 unanswered points against an Oregon team playing without quarterback Justin Herbert.
And I was saying that with Quint Dempsey, it felt like people didn't respond differently to him scoring a goal versus anybody else. But in the Husky game, their first touchdown of the game was not the case. People reacted differently to that one.
And why was that?
Well, you tell me.
Because it was Dante Pettis?
Because it was Dante Pettis.
Because it was Dante Pettis setting the all-time record for NBA punt returns?
It felt like the adulation that people had for Dante Pettis returns a punt weaving throughout the Oregon special teams.
Oh, such a great play.
Such a great play. We can see it building up from the end zone. And so not only does it give the Huskies, they were tied at 3 at this point, it gives the Huskies the 10-3 lead, and kind of an insurmountable 10-3 lead. But Dante Pettis, with another punt return touchdown, breaks Wes Welker's NCAA record for career punt return touchdowns. Unbelievable.
It was also great for him to do it in like
Dante is so good.
A rivalry game, as opposed to, like, you know, his first two touchdowns of the year at home were against, you know, weak non-conference opponents. where those games were really much more anticlimactic. Even
for the record, I would have accepted punt return touchdowns in any game.
For sure. I'm not saying otherwise.
But it's against Oregon. It gives the Huskies the lead. It was such a huge play. And you could feel the entire stadium cheering on not just the Huskies in that play, right? A lot of times they'll score and it's, you know, it's not about Hunter Bryant. It's not about Miles Gaskin or whatever. This was about Dante Pettis. And it felt like more so than any other touchdown we've seen, maybe any other moment we've seen at home for this entire year, this was the most important moment we've seen.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. So it was interesting. I mean, at first we were pretty terrified of Oregon, despite Braxton Burmeister being at the controls of the offense. They drive 62 yards on 15 plays on their opening drive before settling for a field goal, and then we're driving again in a game that was that they led 3-0 because Tristan Vizcaino missed his first field goal attempt of the day, driving again and down to the Washington 30 until a fumble by Kenny Benoit that was recovered by the Huskies, and then that was basically it. The rest of the first half, they had a combined total of 36 yards or 47 yards on their subsequent five drives and only managed to record a first down twice.
Man. Now, so what I'm hoping is that what we saw on Saturday is a little bit of a preview about if we can switch directions to what we're going to see on Friday against Stanford.
I am not that optimistic, but we'll see.
But what I was saying to you during this game against Oregon was, if the Huskies have a lead, let Royce Freeman run for 4 or 5 yards, especially once that lead started getting bigger and bigger. There's a difference between running the ball in a 3-3 game versus running the ball in a 14-3 game and a 21-3 game.
Well, the Huskies are a lot like, you know, the classic Seahawks in terms of, yeah, they're a very fearsome team to come from behind against because of their secondary, because of their ability to put pressure on the quarterback, and then because of their ability to generally run the football well and, you know, run the clock down. All of those things speak well of them when playing from ahead. Now, the problem with your little 4-yard, 5-yard theory with Royce Freeman is that his runs typically go for that distance. Bryce Love's runs typically go for first downs on average when he touches the ball.
That's
He's averaging
insane.
9.6 yards per carry this season. He's got 1,456 yards already, missed a game. He's only played 8 games. So if you go by in terms of his average yards per game rushing, that's 179.2. That would rank 50th in the country among teams. Not far behind the Huskies, who are averaging 188 yards per ground on the game.
Man.
But it's fascinating because it didn't happen for Bryce Love on Saturday at Washington State as he came back from injury, having missed their narrow escape against Oregon State without him. Held to a season-low 69 yards, 52 of which came on one play. And it was the only time this year he's been held to less than 7.6 yards per carry. He was at 4.3. So this is going to be a fascinating matchup against a Huskies defense that, despite not being quite as dominant on the ground against Oregon, is still second in the nation in yards per carry allowed at 2.6 yards per game.
Unheard of 2.6 yards per play.
Not really. I mean, TCU is better than them, and then Alabama is tied for them with them at 2.6 yards per carry.
So good. So what happened on Saturday? Did you get to watch any of this?
I watched, I think, the fourth quarter of this game, and I guess parts of the third quarter as well. And I mean, Stanford really couldn't do much of anything offensively without Bryce Love going. So,
but how did they stop Bryce Love?
I mean, I don't know if I have a good answer for you. There wasn't.
They just did.
They just did it. It's like I remember Tony Allen talking about, he was quoted at one point about, like, hey, how do you get over screens when you're going coming off an off-ball screen and, you know, defending some star who's coming off this? He was like, you just do it.
Man, I got to learn from Tony Allen because I'm really bad at that.
Yeah, you definitely do need to learn from Tony Allen. So after that Oregon State game, Stanford changed quarterbacks. They went from Keller Crist, who had taken over the job during 2016, and
Doesn't Stanford do this every year midseason?
They really do seem to change quarterbacks midseason a lot. And went to redshirt freshman KJ Costello, who has been really effective overall this season, particularly if you look at ESPN's QBR, where Crist is rated at 50.1 and Costello is at 88.0, which is second in the Pac-12.
Man.
behind Khalil Tate from Arizona.
But how many games? What is the sample size there?
It is not very large. He's had thrown 87 attempts so far this year, and I think a lot of that before last Saturday was in garbage time against non-conference opponents. Basically easier situations. But Christ has completed 53.8% of his passes for 6.6 yards per attempt. Costello is at 60.9% completion for 7.1 yards per attempt and has just one interception in 87 attempts. Has also been excellent this season on his handful of runs. He's had 8 carries for 58 yards and 3 touchdowns, including he did have one on Saturday against Wazoo. But passing the football was 9 of 20 for 105 yards against the Cougars.
Man.
So you are definitely going to see the Huskies load up against the run and dare. It's going to be interesting. Like, they basically never play anything but nickel. It's going to be weird to see the Huskies not play nickel, probably.
So there was discussion of, I mean, they're going to rotate a lot. They're going to give a lot of different looks, but they might still play nickel. You know, it's not like they can tackle out of the nickel.
They can, but as Chris Peterson joked about earlier this week, they're going to be seeing a team with a fullback. Had to reintroduce the team to the concept of it.
Unheard of in college football. I love it.
The Seahawks might be less acquainted with the concept of fullback.
I think Pep Hamilton might be their offensive coordinator. But there was reports that Azeem Victor was working as kind of a pure defensive end this week. Did you see that?
Well, I mean, that's what he's been. He's been playing as a 3-4 outside linebacker, a rush end.
And that we might see a little bit more of him there this week.
I mean, I think that would make some sense this week. You know, his tackling ability could be more valuable in this matchup than the ability of guys like, you know, Tevis Bartlett or Connor O'Brien or Benim Potuahe to get off the ball and get upfield to put pressure. That's not as much your concern here is trying to be able to contain and tackle Bryce Love.
Yeah.
So I think that makes a lot of sense here. If you essentially are playing 3 inside linebackers against Stanford with Victor joining Ben Burkervin and Kishon Bieria, who have usurped his job at inside linebacker.
I like it. I mean, I didn't really see this game against Wazoo. I'd be curious to see what they did. If it's that Bryce Love just is a step slower after being injured, or, I mean, you're talking about how KJ Costello is a better quarterback passing the ball than Keller Christ, and it's kind of like, what happened then?
I mean, and maybe he isn't. I mean, maybe there's a reason he wasn't starting all along.
Yes.
But, yeah, I don't know. Maybe he isn't. I mean, for the Huskies' standpoint, I hope so.
But I am totally fine with them letting KJ Costello beat them.
Oh, obviously. Yeah, I mean, but other teams have. It's not like teams just discovered that strategy. Other teams have lost to Stanford and have been just run all over by.
This is the best rush defense in the country, though.
It is.
This is not just another team.
And Stanford, it's interesting. I mean, I'm surprised that they are still as in the Football Power Index rankings as they are, which certainly they are not. If you look at
the way that plays cheat stats,
does it? I mean, basically, what they've done is they've really blown out a handful of opponents. They beat Rice 62-7 in their opener in Australia, beat UCLA by 24 at home, beat Oregon by 42 at home, which is more than the Huskies beat Oregon by.
Huskies let up.
Perhaps. But then you also look at, you know, all three of their losses have been on the road so far, the others coming out at USC by 18 and then at San Diego State.
Have they lost at home yet?
They have not lost at home.
Oh, God.
But they're the best opponent they've played at home, you know, once you account for the fact that Herbert didn't play against Oregon, is probably UCLA, I guess, who does not look super great at this point. I mean, this is going to be their toughest test at home by far.
Okay, so what about the Husky offense going against Stanford's defense?
So the Stanford defense has been surprisingly mediocre for Stanford. They rank 51st in efficiency in the Football Power Index, down from 10th. Last season. So this is unfamiliar territory for Stanford. I have it backwards on the notes. I screwed that up. Their run defenses give you up 4.7 yards per carry, and they've been kind of just in the middle of the pack in terms of their pass defense. So, you know, I think there's the opportunity for the Huskies, despite the injuries that they have at the receiver position, to, you know, we saw a nice game from Aaron Fuller stepping up into a larger role last week. There's an opportunity for them, I think, to move the football against Stanford, particularly if they can be, you know, control the game on the ground. This is not the UCLA run defense we're talking about here, but it is still a team they should be able to run against. So,
well, and I think what we really saw was we said it opened things up a little bit. again, this was last week against Oregon. Against UCLA, it was something that they didn't do. They said, we're going to run the ball.
They didn't need to do. They maybe, sure. maybe didn't want to do.
But against Oregon, we finally saw an offense that seemed like they were trying to utilize their weapons. They were running the ball well. They were getting the ball to Dante Pettis downfield, which they hadn't done a lot of. I mean, that touchdown pass to begin the second half with Dante dead center down the field was something that was very interesting to see and that we haven't really seen much this year. Then also having options to get Jake open receivers in Aaron Fuller down the field was something that we hadn't seen for a few weeks.
Wait,
plus,
yeah, okay, when are you going to get to this?
The most important player to unleash on the team, the most explosive player on the team, finally was unleashed.
He sure was. Savon Ahmed with a 58-yard touchdown in this game.
And a casual 58-yard touchdown.
I don't know how casual a 58-yard touchdown can be, but yes.
That's the thing about Savon Ahmed is he is so explosive. Anytime he touches the ball, there is a chance that he is going to break it for a touchdown.
Yep.
And that's why he needs to touch the ball a lot and in a lot of different situations.
Yep. No, I agree with that. I mean, I think an interesting thing in this matchup, Ahmed didn't really do much in terms of kick returning on Saturday, but this is the rare case where the Huskies are going to be at a special teams disadvantage. Stanford's special teams ranks 6th in the country in FBI efficiency. Huskies up to 16th despite their kicking foibles after Tristan Vizcaino did make a field goal and went 5 of 5 on extra points last Saturday. You know, if you take that Dante Pettis out of the equation, then that maybe does even things a little bit up a little bit from Stanford's standpoint. And they also have had perhaps the best kicker in the Pac-12 so far this year in Jet Toner, which is an amazing name. And
Jet Toner.
Not sadly his actual name.
Oh.
It's his initials. his initials are J-E-T, and that's why he goes by Jet.
Oh.
But he was not named
he's
that.
Like
but
Joe Bluth.
He's 15 of 17 on field goals so far this season.
Okay. Well, we believe in Tristan Vizcaino now.
Do we?
Yeah.
Like, if this is a close game, do you believe in Tristan Vizcaino?
No. I believe in Savon Ahmed.
Me too. I mean, hopefully this isn't a close game. Do you want to do chances of victory? You got anything else to say here?
Should we propose a friendly wager with Third Pelton brother Ben B., a graduate of Stanford University?
And fan of Stanford. What do you have in mind? For him to accept via this podcast invitation.
That he has no say in. What is something, it's more about, because to me, I feel like the worst thing that Ben B could do is talk positively about Derek Carr.
I agree.
So if Stanford loses, we have not talked about this at all.
Nope.
We're just proposing it right here. But I feel like if Stanford loses, Ben has to find something positive to say about Derek Carr.
Okay. But what do we have to do if Stanford wins?
What is the... I honestly don't know. You might have to dig deep. What is the worst thing that you can do for yourself?
Well, I think we should do it for both of us. I don't think it should be specifically just me.
I want to focus more on you.
I think we should have to tweet positive things about fullbacks.
That's not the same.
It's not our show.
Have you seen how much Ben B hates Derek Carr?
Should we have to tweet mean things about Jermaine Kearse?
Oh, man.
Or Daryl Bevel. I'm just checking off boxes on the Bingo Square now. Should we have to complain about the MLS season being too short?
Maybe. We'll also leave it up to Ben B. First off, he doesn't have to accept this. But
yeah, we should give him the choice. Now he's got some things to think about.
But yes. I'm just trying to think of something where... I mean, it's not that I like Derek Carr, but nobody hates Derek Carr as much as Ben B hates Derek Carr.
That's true. That is very true.
And so he needs to recognize for you and me what the thing is that we hate the most.
Okay. Yeah, I'm curious to see what he comes back with if he in fact accepts this.
Is he better?
All right. So before we make this wager, what do you think is the chances of us?
We'll send him a hat either way. If he accepts. If he accepts, we'll send him a hat. How about that?
I think we're probably sending him a hat no matter what.
No, only if he accepts the bet. There we go. All right. I think it's better than 50% for the Huskies, especially seeing what Wazoo did last week with Bryce Love. Especially, it gives me a little bit of hope. Seeing this Husky run defense, they weren't perfect against Royce Freeman, but I think that they can hold Stanford enough to 14 points, 17 points, something like that. you know, maybe 21. But I think the Husky offense will also be good enough that they'll be able to get by. What we need to accept right now is that on the first drive of this game that Stanford has, they are going to score. And we are going to think that the game is over at that point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's hard for us because we're quick to predict that games are over.
Yes.
We're quick to call games over, usually on the first drive. We were ready to leave against Oregon on their driving down on the second drive.
Unless the Huskies are losing, in which case, or are winning, rather, in which case, as you'll recall from last year's Oregon victory, I think it was still like late in the third quarter. We were still super nervous.
You don't feel comfortable until you're at 70.
Yeah. Until Jake Brownie has pointed at someone.
But I do think that with the way that the offense looked last week, granted this is a better defense, but with the way that the offense looked last week, the way that they incorporated Savon Ahmed, the things that Dante Pettis can do, Jake Browning's looking pretty good. Both of the running backs look pretty good. I like the screen pass to LaVon Coleman. I liked everything about it. I think given that and the way that it seems like maybe they've figured out how to create a little bit of offense without Hunter Bryan out there, without throwing every single pass to Will Dissly, that I think the Huskies have a 60% chance of winning this game.
Yeah, I mean, I'm torn between like 60 and 65%. So maybe this time I'm going to split the difference and go with a solid 62.5%.
Nice.
Chance of winning. That's in line with what FPI says, which is 64%. I feel like this is a pretty good matchup for the Huskies. Like, they generally do well against teams that try to do the same thing as them. I also feel like the Pac-12 after dark potential here, and I could live to regret this, is mitigated by the fact that these are like the two least Pac-12 after dark schools in the Pac-12.
Yeah, the Huskies have played in the Coach Pete era like one real Pac-12 after dark game. That
Arizona State, you could qualify. I think that qualifies.
It was like a 14-7 game, wasn't it?
It was, but it was still
nothing even really crazy happened.
Yeah, I guess so. Them losing was crazy.
Coach Pete is not a Pac-12 after dark type coach.
He's not, and you know who else isn't a Pac-12 after dark type coach?
David Shaw.
Or Jim Harbaugh, or Pep Hamilton, just anyone involved with the Stanford program. Or Coach Pete.
Yes. But Coach Pete's going to have the team ready to play. You know, they're going to know what to expect going into it. I don't see them being overwhelmed by the moment, but this is the biggest game that they've played all year so far.
Yes.
This is the game that we had circled. Stanford hasn't quite lived up to expectations, but this is the game that we had circled on the schedule. Since this, we knew Friday night going into Stanford would most likely decide the Pac-12 North. And well, still,
there's Tim Pullman that might have something to say about that.
But this is still going to go a long way to decide the Pac-12 North.
It is.
Especially for the Huskies.
So, yeah, we'll see. All right. You talked about things we felt good about. Now let's talk about some things we feel bad about.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
Okay, I'm going to go first here.
You're going first?
I am going first here. We've made a change because I have come up with a new grievance. Russell Wilson is a hero to many in Seattle, but I'm here today to tell you that he's a very specific type of hero, a tragic hero. In the grand tradition of the Greek gods, Russell has one fatal flaw that brings him down. And like Achilles' vulnerable heel, it's a seemingly small thing that looms large. Now, you might think I'm making a pun referring to his height here, but nobody actually thinks that Russell Wilson's height is a problem anymore, except NFL scouts who would rather draft punters and writers who rank quarterbacks online. The rest of us realize that Russell Wilson's height is not an issue. No, Russell Wilson's fatal flaw is simpler yet. He cannot play in the rain. And we might never know this if Wilson had been drafted by the Chargers, but somehow he ended up in the wettest city in the NFL. Alanis Morissette might call it ironic. We've always suspected that Wilson plays worse in the rain, with his 53.3% completion percentage in Sunday's loss to Washington as the latest example. As usual, however, I wanted to make sure our minds weren't playing tricks on us, so I looked up the numbers.
You looked up the numbers for Russell Wilson playing in the rain?
You're damn right I did. During Wilson's career, the Seahawks have played 27 regular season home games on days when Weather Underground has recorded rain as compared to 17 dry games. Side note, we should air some grievances about Seattle weather during the winter. During the rainy games, Wilson has completed 61.6% of his passes for 88.0 yards per attempt. When it's dry, Those marks improved to 68.8% wow. completions and 8.8 yards per attempt. Wilson throws more touchdowns, 6.5% of his passes versus 5.9%, and fewer interceptions, 2.1% versus 1.5% when it's dry. In short, he's a totally different player. Here's the kicker. The Seahawks have gone 20-7 in the 27 games at home with rain that day. Pretty good, but not what you expect given the home field advantage provided by the 12th man. Here's why. The Seahawks have never lost the 17 dry games they've played at home since Russell Wilson
arrived. What is your grievance here?
My grievance is against the rain.
Not the Seattle rain, as were previously mentioned.
No, not them. Or the former women's basketball Seattle rain. I didn't look up playoff rain, but given the Seahawks are undefeated at home in the playoffs with Wilson, we can say they have never lost at home with him.
Oh my God.
On a dry day.
That's amazing.
Where the other precipitation that's being shed is our tears as the Seahawks are losing. So when we're forecasting the next Seahawks home game, I'm not going to consult DVOA. I'm not going to look at opponent injuries. Instead, I'm only going to go look at the weather report.
Your grievance is kind of delivered like Mickey Rooney, I felt. Especially with like the joke at the end. But I'm shocked by these numbers.
Are you?
Russell Wilson hasn't lost when it isn't raining.
I mean, that kind of blew me. And obviously, it's somewhat fluky. Like, there was last year's Dolphins game where they, you know, Russell Wilson did not play well, but they won at the end.
Still, they haven't lost.
I think the fumble gate, Detroit, the back gate, I should say, I think that might have been a
try. And the fail Mary.
Yeah, that's another one. So there's obviously been a fair amount of luck involved in getting to 17-0, but still 17-0?
That's amazing.
The Seahawks should build a freaking roof. Like, it honestly would be worth it. I don't know how much that would cost, but it would be worth it because you would win the Super Bowl every year.
You should start talking to Jenny Durkin. I'm just so upset about this game. And, like, I can't exactly pinpoint why I'm upset about the game. There's not one thing where it's like, oh, I'm not mad at Blair Walsh. He just missed some field goals. He wasn't trying to miss field goals. I'm not mad at Russell Wilson for playing worse. He plays worse in the rain. And also, by the way, you should look up the stats in the fourth quarter. Because why is Russell Wilson so much better in the fourth quarter of these games?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone knows that.
It's just unbelievable. I mean, he's better in the fourth quarter of every game. But on these rain games, why is he so much better? Do you see? I think this was DVOA or DR-wise. He was the best quarterback for the entire week in the fourth quarter. And the worst in the first three quarters?
Wait, seriously?
His
fourth quarter was better than everyone else over the full game?
No. Oh, just he was just the best in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, I think they also had a stat that he had the... Or maybe that was in the month of October where he had the best quarterback rating in NFL history. I guess that was that.
And it was like, I can't even complain. Like, I want to complain. I mean, I have got complaints about the offensive line. But they didn't even really run that much. There was the one series where they ran the ball twice, just pounding into the line with Eddie Lacy. Eddie Lacy, by the way, could not have gotten injured soon enough. Maybe that's what a...
Eddie Lacy and Thomas Rawls have been the same player this year.
Thomas Rawls, I think, is maybe a little bit better now.
A little bit.
They've been the same player this year, and that player is really bad.
No, that's undoubtedly true.
That's fine if they're the same player. But I don't have a grievance specifically with them because they ran okay in this game.
They did.
It's like I'm a little bit upset with Pete Carroll for his time management at the end of the game.
I don't think it was that bad.
They gave up some time.
Wait 20 seconds before calling the timeout on third down.
20 seconds.
That's unjustifiable. You either wait the whole time or you call it immediately.
Do one or the other.
Yes. But the rest of the complaints, I think, were rather dubious.
Also, how do you run the Super Bowl 49 play again? On the two-point conversion, like, what was Russ even seeing when he threw that pass?
Are we sure it was the same play?
Okay, maybe it wasn't the same play, but it was something very similar, and there was nobody open. Let's just get that one out of the playbook. But I'm not even necessarily mad at Daryl Bevel, because I felt like the play calling was maybe okay in this game.
It would have been great if it hadn't been raining. So many deep passes.
He had that one pass where Russ stepped up into the pocket and threw it over the defense and Baldwin was coming out. Did you see this? Baldwin was like, had beaten the safety in the middle of the field and just sailed right over his head. Just like, God damn it, Russell.
Well, you're used to like, you know, you were at the game, but when you watch on TV, it's like they show Russ loading up to throw deep and they cut to the receiver and you're like, obviously he's going to be open and this is going to be completed because this is just what the Seahawks do. And then it wasn't.
I mean, he was open, but it wasn't completed. But it's just like, across the board, am I mad at the defense? Like, the defense played good in this game. The Seahawks outgained them by almost double the amount of yards. I can't be mad at the defense for giving up that drive at the end of the game. They gave up one drive, and Kirk Cousins made some unbelievable plays. Literally, I don't believe them.
you think that you
I refuse to accept them. This game is
edited in front of you.
It just ruined my week. It's like, going into this, I'm standing there. I don't want to complain about I need to stand for a second.
Oh, no.
But it's like, I'm at this game, and I don't want to complain about the fans being at the game that much. But there are so many people there who are just like canoodling during the game, having a good time, not even focused, not cheering, not making noise. And it's like, this matters to me, right? Like, this, if the Seahawks lose, it is going to fuck up my week. I'm clearly still upset about it. I'm like reading things on Football Outsiders. I'm looking at Ben B's tweets from the games, and I'm angry every single time. And I'm still angry. I'm not even okay that they're playing on Thursday. I don't care. I'm still so angry about this game.
You don't want to wipe this taste from your mouth more quickly?
No, I want to feel it.
Oh, wow. You just want to stew it.
But I just don't know what. And also, they defended Chris Thompson well. Like
they really did.
If you would have told me, if you would have given me these stats and said this was the game, even with the amount of incompletions Russell had, I would have said the Seahawks would have won by 2 touchdowns.
Which is why the Seahawks went up in DVOA after this game. They got better.
It's just,
they were overrated last week after they got lucky to beat Houston at home. That was not a good performance. And by the way, Deshaun Watson.
God,
heartbreaking.
I've never been more upset about...
No, we're not toasting. We're pouring one out.
I read the room. I've never been more upset about an opponent injury than I have been about this Deshaun Watson injury.
I mean, I was
That also upset. Didn't affect me fantasy-wise.
Right, I was doubly upset because he did affect me fantasy-wise, but yeah, I mean, it sucks.
I mean, it affected me by destroying Tom Savage, by destroying Will Fuller. Tom Savage has been destroyed long ago, but...
Macho Man Tom Savage, put some respect on that name.
But it's just it's even harder that I don't have one person. I'm gonna have a spin-off podcast where I just gonna be me delivering monologues complaining about the fans of the game. So if you want
to
hear,
hey, at least they showed up to the game, unlike the student section against Oregon.
God. If you want to,
it was a little chilly, I grant.
Hit me at peltoncast@gmail.com if you want to hear my complaints about home fans. But there's no home field advantage anymore. It's just like everything about this game makes me upset. There's no one thing. It's just every single thing about this game made me upset.
Yeah. No, I completely feel you.
But I have a different grievance.
I also have something I'm upset about. Is it just the fact
that... Are we going back and forth? We got a lot of problems with you people.
We do.
Yeah.
The timing of this game meant that you can't even be happy on a weekend where the Huskies beat Oregon. Like, that should just be... I mean, if the games had been reversed... I feel like as upset as you have been about the Seahawks game, you still would have gotten over it if the Huskies had beaten Oregon after the Seahawks lost to Washington.
I'm telling you, I've got an alternative take for you.
Okay.
We're not excited about beating Oregon because we're giving them the Don Draper, I don't think about you at all. We don't care about beating Oregon because Oregon doesn't matter to us. Do you know who matters to us? Alabama matters to us.
Well, let's get there.
Georgia matters to us.
Pressing the college football playoff matters.
TCU, Notre Dame. Those teams matter to us. By the way, I would love to play Notre Dame.
Oh, bring on Notre Dame. Although Notre Dame rates surprisingly well in FPI. The Huskies only barely passed them with their win over and up to 4th in FPI, 9th in the college football playoff rankings.
Those teams matter. Oregon with their Burmeister at quarterback, no relation.
I mean, they're going to be good next year when Justin Herbert is healthy.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
Fear Oregon.
I might fear Oregon down the road, but I do not fear Oregon right now. And somehow, very quickly, we've gotten over beating Oregon.
We've gotten accustomed to beating Oregon. And
yeah.
We've gotten acclimated to it too quickly.
It feels good.
We should enjoy
but
it
But also,
bit.
We've got the Stanford game right there in the schedule. We beat Oregon. We're on to the next one. There's a lot more. We've got...
All right, thanks, Jay-Z.
We've got Stanford. We've got Utah. We've got Wazoo. And then hopefully we have the Pac-12 championship. And then Bama!
Actually, you know what? No, you almost said bring on Bama. Actually, that was I should have said you
bring on Georgia.
You were Bill Belichick there, not Jay-Z. Would have been the better reference. All right, you have one more grievance, or was that it?
My last grievance is not Seahawk related or Husky related at all.
Okay.
My last grievance is with all these teams choosing to throw away their seasons instead of signing Colin Kaepernick.
It's unbelievable.
Like, if I was a fan, this is an empathetic, I'm having a lot of empathy here. First for Deshaun Watson, second for the fans of the Texans, third for the fans of the Packers.
And specifically for Shea Serrano.
Yeah. I would be so furious with my team if they looked at the situation. Let's say that I'm a Texans fan and signed Josh Johnson and Matt McGloin instead of signing Colin Kaepernick.
You forgot Brandon Whedon. Was he also in
there?
Did
they sign Brandon Whedon?
It was someone else, wasn't there?
I don't think they signed Brandon Whedon, but he's like 45 now.
There was the third player the Texans signed.
They already had Macho Man Tom Savage. If I was a fan of the Texans and saw that they signed those players instead of Kaepernick and just said, we're done, the season doesn't matter, we are so unwilling to bring attention to the team. I'm not even sure what it is. These teams are so consumed with my hot take. I'll say it my hot take way offline, but they are so consumed bringing any added attention to the team.
Yeah, it's not. I was just wrong.
There's no them. Brandon Whedon. Come on. You're seeing Brandon Whedon's all over the place.
Yeah, I sure am.
That they are willing to give up an entire season. A promising, like the Packers could have made the playoffs, but instead they're throwing Brett Hundley out there. They're throwing Macho Man Tom Savage out there with the Texans. I would be furious about this. I mean, and it is ridiculous.
I'm a little upset as it is that the Seahawks haven't signed Colin Kaepernick as a backup.
No, and we're talking about signing him as a backup. The Seahawks are not even throwing away their season, and I'm angry that they haven't signed him as a backup. This is ridiculous.
Yep. There's nothing else to say. It's ridiculous. Oh, do you want to talk about another team that's playing its backup quarterback, by the way? That's the Arizona Cardinals.
Oh, I'm so angry about this Washington game.
Who, weirdly, are 7-3 with Drew Stanton as their starting quarterback, despite the fact that Drew Stanton is...
I refuse to believe this.
...not good at football. He is completing 45.5% of his passes so far this season. And since 2014, which was the last time he really started for an extended period of time, he has completed 42.7% of his passes. He has 2 picks in 42 attempts.
Speaking of teams throwing away their seasons instead of signing Colin Kaepernick.
I mean, in fairness, this is the style Arizona wants, because Stanton has provided the big play. He's averaging 13.4 yards per completion, similar to the 13.1 he averaged in 2014 when he started 8 games, which would rank 3rd in the NFL if he qualified, behind Jared Goff and the aforementioned Deshaun Watson. So it's fascinating that he's 7-3 as a starter. I decided to look into this a little bit. And so Stanton has 15 career games where he's thrown at least 20 pass attempts. 6 of those games, he's completed 50% of his passes or less or worse. In the NFL as a whole, over the last decade, teams have won 23.1% of games where the quarterback has thrown at least 20 passes and completed half of them or less. Drew Stanton has 6 of those games. His teams have gone 5-1 in them.
Wow!
Cam Newton, who's 9-6, and Andrew Luck, 6-4, are the only two others who are above 500 with more than five starts. So here's what I'm proposing.
Drew Stanton has broken the system.
And weirdly, John Skelton at 3-2 is the other next best guy.
I mean, you have to... That was also with Arizona under Bruce Arians.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm proposing, is that from here on out, we call these games the Stanton. If you throw at least 20 pass attempts, complete less than half of them, that's a Stanton.
And you win.
I don't think you necessarily have to win. I think it's a Stanton either way.
Okay.
But maybe
it's 5-1.
People can debate whether you want to win. So, I mean, there are some reasons for this, because of the fact that he's throwing all these deep passes. He's more likely to win games even when he's not completing many of them.
It kind of makes you think maybe teams should throw more deep passes overall, but yes.
Teams should throw more deep passes overall. But the other thing is the Cardinals are getting so lucky, and this was true even when Carson Palmer was playing quarterback. So they're 4-4. They have a chance with a win this week to tie the Seahawks in the standings, despite ranking 27th in the NFL in DVOA.
Yeah, I mean, looking at this 4-4, it's got to be the weakest 4 wins that you could possibly have. I mean, there are weaker wins out there, I suppose, but...
Their 4 wins have come by an average of 5.2 points per game. 2 of them have come in overtime. 2 of them have come against the 49ers, who are winless.
Yes.
1 of them has come against the Colts. I forget who the other one is.
Tampa Bay.
Their 4 losses have come by an average of 20.8 points per game. So their point differential overall, minus 7.8 points per game, ranks 27th in the NFL at 4-4. That is amazing.
Basically, when they have played good teams, they've gotten destroyed. And then I don't even know what to consider the Buccaneers as a good or a bad team.
Oh, they're a bad team.
But
I don't know whether to question this, consider the Seahawks a good team or not.
The Seahawks. Hold on, let me see where the Buccaneers rate DVOA was.
I think they're getting close to the abysmal eight. Aaron Schatz is
25th. Yeah. So when Arizona has played bad teams, they've won close games. And when they played good teams, Philadelphia, St. Louis, the St. Louis Rams.
St. Louis.
Philadelphia.
That's that East Coast bias against the Rams.
LA Rams, Cowboys. They've gotten destroyed in those games.
Yep. That's very true.
So we're hoping for this one that the Seahawks are a good team. And statistically, they are.
Yeah, we'll see. So the other interesting thing that's going on with the Cardinals. They were overrated before. They're underrated now. The other interesting thing that's going on with the Cardinals is that they brought in Adrian Peterson a few weeks ago. Before that, their running backs with David Johnson out were giving Seahawks-esque performance, I would say. Chris Johnson was averaging 2.
Well, I thought running backs didn't matter. Everybody's told me running backs don't matter. All that matters is your line.
Running backs may matter a tiny bit. Chris Johnson was averaging 2.5 yards per carry. Kerwin Williams was averaging 2.2 yards per carry.
Chris Johnson was averaging, he's still in the NFL, yards per carry?
That is very true. So Adrian Peterson coming in at averaging 4.2 yards per carry, even if that's like basically average his performance so far, that looks like, by comparison, like he is Adrian Peterson in his prime.
Yes.
Much like Chris Carson's performance for the Seahawks looks the same way compared to the rest of their running backs. But it is worth noting that if you look at Adrian Peterson's average of 104.7 yards per game and are amazed that he's doing this in Arizona since he got traded from New Orleans, that's really more a product of volume than efficiency. He had 37 carries last week. That is tied for the second highest total in the entire decade of the 2010s.
What?
Le'Veon Bell had 38 carries last year. That's the only person since the 2010, start of 2010.
I love that they did it with their 32-year-old running back.
Did you see Bruce Arians quote after the game?
No.
He was like, the football isn't that heavy. Like, that's a great attitude.
What does that even mean?
Like, the actual carrying it is not that hard.
Tackling that's bad, Bruce
we
Arians.
We all understand that. Bruce Arians, apparently not.
Okay, that's a very strange quote. It's a very Bruce Arians quote.
That is very
What Bruce college Arians. Team do you think he's going to coach when he gets fired?
You know, Bruce Arians is going to... if he leaves, it'll be because he elects to retire, because Bruce Arians is almost as old as Pete Carroll.
Really?
Yeah. Bruce Arians is very old. Again, almost as old as Pete Carroll. The big play threat that they have on offense really doesn't have anything to do with Larry Fitzgerald, who's basically just a volume receiver at this point and has been kind of average. He's at 65, by the way. Has really kind of been average this year with their poor quarterback play. So the big play threat, they've got Jerron Brown is averaging 15 yards a catch. John Brown is averaging 16.1 yards per catch. And J.J. Nelson is averaging 16.6
The big play threat is everybody else.
Yes.
Underneath, it's Larry Fitzgerald. Deep, it's every other wide receiver.
Yes. John Brown has been pretty weak this year. He's only catching 40% of the passes thrown his direction. So I think it's really Jerron Brown and J.J. Nelson who you need to be scared of as the Seahawks secondary.
I mean, this is a game where, because of the amount of deep balls that Arizona throws, where you just really want Earl to be able to play.
I know. And
I understand that there's a very long break coming after this, and you don't want to rush Earl back. And Bradley McDougal looked good.
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear that anything that happened to the Seahawks, to this extent that their defense did break down in that final play, would have necessarily been any different with Earl Thomas, because it was all completions to the sidelines. It wasn't deep balls.
It was two passes. It was a very small sample size.
But it is a little concerning that Washington may just have been scared to attack the Seahawks deep until that drive, when they did so extremely successfully.
Yes.
Granted, against the blitz.
Arizona is not going to be scared to attack
the
Seahawks.
They're going to do it. They're going to come out doing that. They're going to keep doing it, and they're going to do it.
It's going to be amazing watching Stanford and then Arizona in consecutive days. No, it's also kind of amazing to look at Arizona's offense, where basically they are either going to run the ball with Adrian Peterson, which they did a lot, or they are going to throw it really far.
I mean, sometimes they throw it to Larry Fitzgerald a lot, and sometimes
they've got
the
old guys who do the short stuff.
Sometimes they throw it to Jermaine Gresham, who is not good.
Man.
So at the other side of the football, the Cardinals
defense,
going to
be a very weird game.
Perhaps. Cardinals defense pretty average across the board, I'd say. The the guy who's going to get the film treatment is the standout against the Seahawks offensive line this week is Chandler Jones, who has as many sacks, 9, as the entire rest of the team combined. No one else has more than 1.5 sacks. And they're 29th overall in adjusted
Why
sack
didn't
rate.
They re-sign Calais Campbell? Jesus Christ.
I mean, I don't know if they can afford it.
Okay.
If somehow Dwayne Brown could shut down Chandler Jones, the Seahawks offense, Russell Wilson might have some time to throw, but I'm just not going to get my hopes up on that one.
Does Chandler Jones only line up on one side, or does he move around? The problem is, it's like, you've got Jermaine Ifedi on the other side. I'm sure that Chandler Jones can rush from over there.
Right. I mean, they list him as strong side, weak side. They don't list him as left or right, like Washington does, where we knew that Ryan Kerrigan was going to get to feast against Jermaine Ifedi all day. Hey, penalties. Those are fun.
Although it was one of my other grievances. How do you get a penalty on a kickoff? How did they get the offsides?
What, like, that was a really frustrated one. Delano Hill. God, calling you out, Delano Hill.
Such a stupid penalty.
You were looking for someone to be mad at. That's it.
Just blame Delano Hill for that 5 yards. Okay.
Surprising that the Cardinals are 14th in rush defense DVOA, and I've written these down wrong before in the past, so maybe I should go double check that I actually have this right before we put this out. But they're only allowing 3.5 yards per carry to running backs, but I think that maybe there's been more consistency that would apply, because they've really struggled in terms of short yardage situations. They're not, you know, stuffing a lot of runs in the backfield, missing Calais Campbell quite certainly there. And yes, it is correct that they are 14th in rush defense DVOA. One place the Seahawks could have an advantage here, despite the fact that it's been something of a liability, I would say, certainly last week, is special teams, where Arizona comes in ranked number 31 in DVOA. They have the worst kicking in the NFL. Phil Dawson, who has replaced the Catman, Chandler Catanzaro, for them, is 12 of 18 on field goals, which is much worse than even after last week, Blair Walsh at 12 of 16. And has 4 misses from less than 40 yards. He's gone 4 of 8 on kicks between 30 and 39 yards, which is bad.
How do they not have another kicker?
I mean, he is good on kickoffs, which is like one of the bright spots for the special teams. Also, opponents are averaging 12.1 yards per punt return, and unlike a couple weeks ago when we talked about out-kicking your coverage and giving up punt returns that way, Andy Lee is only middle of the pack in gross yardage, so they are one of the worst teams in terms of punts in the NFL, and maybe this is finally the week that Tyler Lockett can get something going on a punt return.
Man, I would love to see an explosive Tyler Lockett special teams play. But looking at the Seahawks versus this Arizona defense, they don't need to run the ball, right? Arizona's defense is a pretty good rush defense. The Seahawks don't need to run the ball. If they do in this game and they run the ball well, great, so be it.
They're going to run the ball.
Or if they end up being in a position where they're up by so much that they can third quarter, fourth quarter run the ball, great, have fun with it. Otherwise, pass the fucking ball. And that's what they should do here, and they should do that against this Arizona secondary over and over and over again. For one game, pretend you're Bruce Arians, and let's try to score some points here and get Drew Stanton making erratic throws downfield.
Are you saying you want Pete Carroll to wear a Kingle hat this week?
I'm okay with it. We want to see Drew Stanton in situations where he's trying to come back. We don't want to see Adrian Peterson run the ball 37 times.
No, we decidedly do not.
I mean, he's probably not going to, but they have to score points this week. And they look, if they go into the fourth quarter with 2 points, I personally think that will be bad.
Hot take.
But they have the opportunity to score points. It's not going to be raining. It'll be a very nice night there in Arizona. Everything should be perfect for the passing offense to work. They should do it early and often.
Yeah. Do we have any thoughts on the Seahawks injury situation?
There are a lot of them. I mean, basically what they get here with this, here's the thought, is that they almost get a bye week because they're going from a Thursday night all the way to a Monday night.
It's a mini bye week.
Yeah. It's an MLS week off. It's an MLS international break is what they have. It's almost like the MLS playoffs that they have coming up here because they're going from playing on, it's like 12 days off, right?
Yes, because they don't play again until Monday night the following week.
So that is one of the longer breaks that they're going to have all season, and it's a good situation for them, which I understand they probably don't need to rush Earl back. We'd love to see him against Arizona. The Seahawks should be able to beat Arizona without Earl.
One intriguing possibility is the potential return of Deion Jordan this week. Which I think there's a role for him to play with Marcus Smith leaving last week's game with a concussion. Presumably he'll not be able to go, despite the fact that he cannot match the production of Dwight Freeney.
How about Dwight Freeney?
37. Just like Dwight Freeney could play forever, apparently.
Man, Dwight Freeney is good. I mean, there's definitely concern about the injury situation. It'll be nice to have that time off. They just need to get there with a win because this is a must-win game.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about, so last week's game, it didn't really change how I feel about the Seahawks. Again, they improved in DVOA. I think the reasons they struggled.
Richard Sherman is doubtful for this game?
I don't think these okay. Pro Football Reference designations are actually accurate.
They must list every single player as questionable or doubtful.
I mean, I think it's just, so the Seahawks haven't had practice the last couple of days, but they've had to list an injury report as if they did. And that's kind of what's going on here. I lost my train of thought. What was I talking about? I'd scrolled you down to the Dwight Freeney section. Was talking about him.
Dwight Freeney was great.
Dwight Freeney is great. The Seahawks should sign more players off, like Hall of Fame players mid-season.
I'm weirdly pro this.
It worked out well with Devin Hester last year. Anyway, last week's game didn't change how I feel about the Seahawks as a team going forward, but it definitely changes their situation going forward, yes. Especially in conjunction with LA winning another blowout and looking like they're number one in the Football Outsiders DVOA rankings now, even with the Seahawks having the tie, the advantage of having one in LA and having the second game between them at home. Still, it's looking like they're going to be tough to catch for the NFC West, and all of a sudden, you need to start stacking as many wins as you possibly can. I mean, I think third Pelton brother Zach Whitman has been pointing out all year that kind of the path for the Seahawks is to go 4-4 on the road and 7-1 at home. Well, guess what? They got that one. They yes. is gone now, and they've got, you know, we'll see what Atlanta is, but they've got an incredibly good Philadelphia team coming to town. And then on the road, you look at playing at Jacksonville, at Dallas. Those are going to be difficult games. You probably need to win the two NFC West games on the road that they have left, this in San Francisco. So, yeah, there's no margin for error now. You have anything to add to that?
Yeah, it sucks. I'm so frustrated about this loss. I'm still not over it. Like I said, it just has ruined my week. Losing to Washington.
Well, they have to... your week can be redeemed because, again, the Seahawks are playing on Thursday. So,
man, I just want a big win here, a big comfortable win. We don't even have to think about it. On Sunday, we can watch NFL Red Zone and feel good.
Seahawks are not familiar with the concept of a comfortable win. They have no idea what you're talking
about. So, statistically, when I look at this game, if we're going to do percentage chance of victory, the team that Arizona, maybe their style doesn't reflect this, but the team that is most similar to Arizona that the Seahawks have played so far, especially on the road, is the New York Giants.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And they are just as bad of a team as the Giants are, and they don't even have their starting quarterback. This is the game that the Seahawks should win comfortably. And again, if they don't, we've got there are a lot bigger issues. You know, the heights that we can see for the Seahawks to achieve this year, if they don't win this game, almost become unattainable.
I would say that as much as I believe in statistical analysis, I'm throwing it out the window here.
Wow.
I don't like the idea of the Cardinals being 5-4 and even with the Seahawks in the standings at second in the NFC West. And it's just I can give them no better than a 50-50 chance of winning this game.
50-50?
That's all I can do.
Well, I think it's more like 75%.
Wow. What's interesting is, by the way, the line on this game is the same as Huskies Stanford.
Really?
Yeah, they're both Seattle team -6 on the road.
Man, if we won both these games, it's going to be such a good weekend.
Yeah.
It's a complicated situation. But, I mean, you're talking about a Seahawks team who's better than Arizona in basically every facet of the game.
Yeah, well, guess what?
And they're starting their backup quarterback.
They were better in every facet of the game than the Washington professional football team. Didn't win that game because sometimes stuff just happens.
It was an unlucky week. They outgained Washington by a lot. But also, can we just get more urgency for the entire game? Can we just run the goddamn no huddle for the entire game? Coming back to grievances. Why can't every quarter be like the fourth quarter?
I don't know. I mean, you know,
teams in college manage to do this the entire game.
It is true.
It's not that hard. People aren't going to get exhausted.
But there's still the level of urgency and also the willingness of Russell Wilson to run the football in those situations is a huge part of it.
At the end of the game?
Yeah.
Well, hoping against Arizona that he does not have to run the football. There should be open receivers. It should be dry out. Everything looks like it's going to go well. This is a game the Seahawks should win and should win easily.
And that's why I'm so scared of it. All right, well, it'll be an interesting week with a pair of midweek games, Thursday night and Friday night, and then the entire weekend off from Seattle football. Hopefully, as you say, it'll be one we'll be enjoying happily in the wake of two wins.
On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.